An early morning house fire in Missoula killed at least 16 house pets. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce talks about gathering votes to override a veto. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a Yellowstone National Park geologist about what scientists may know about the geothermal system in the Old Faithful area. A Missoula house fire caused minor injuries to two residents and killed 16 to 20 pets this morning. The Missoula Fire Department responded at about 6:30 a.m. Three engine companies, one ladder company, and the battalion chief were dispatched to the fire on 1633 Idaho Street off of Russell Street. Missoula Fire Department's Fire Marshal Gordy Hughes says cats, dogs, and reptiles died at the scene.
Tenants and the occupants had gotten out, and they did the best they could to get the animals out of their cages and let the animals out with them as they evacuated. But the fast-moving fire and smoke had built up to a level that was untenable for the animals.
Hugh says the cause of the fire is unknown.
At this time, it is still under investigation, waiting on some follow-up with the investigators.
Damage is estimated to be over $45,000.
And in other news from around the state, time is running out for lawmakers to gather the votes required to override the vetoes of Governor Steve Bullock. Bullock vetoed the second highest number of bills in Montana history this year, a total of 71 bills. Lawmakers have the chance to override those vetoes with a two-thirds majority of both the House and the Senate. The votes to override the governor's vetoes are due in the next couple weeks. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us getting those votes has proven a tough thing to do.
Secretary of State Linda McCullough says only those bills which received a two-thirds vote in both chambers the first time around make the cut for a potential veto override. McCullough's office sends out polls of those vetoed bills to lawmakers to vote again. If each chamber gets two-thirds again, the veto is defeated.
So they need 67 votes in the House of Representatives and 34 votes in the Senate. And they need to have both that number. So if they get 100 votes in the House, they still need 34 votes in the Senate.
24 of Governor Bullock's vetoes reached that initial two-thirds threshold to head out to lawmakers for polling. That's among the most in the last 10 legislative sessions. And a couple of these bills were initially passed by almost the entire legislature, like Senate Bill 344. It was passed by 100% of the lawmakers present in both houses on its final vote. 100%. The bill changed the rules for how the Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks can buy land. Bullock said in his veto letter the legislation limited FWP too much and that compromise amendments supported by his office failed to pass. Many of the other vetoes lawmakers could override. Bullock says he killed for financial reasons. The bill really grabbing headlines here is House Bill 218, which would have created a fund of about $35 million to go toward infrastructure improvements in areas affected by the Bakken oil boom. Some of these eastern Montana communities are badly in need of upgrades to their sewer systems and roads, for instance, to handle quickly rising populations. The bill was sponsored by Colstrip Republican Representative Dwayne Ankeny.
This money wasn't just pork going somewhere. This money is needed money. There's people, families living in small campers out in the middle of farmers' fields. This money would have been used to put infrastructure in so affordable housing could have been built. This is about people.
The governor's office declined an interview for this story, with a spokesperson only saying the governor hopes the legislature understands the need for a balanced budget. In previous interviews, Bullock said the administration did pass millions of dollars in infrastructure funds for eastern Montana. He said vetoing Ankeny's bill was necessary to leave at least $300 million in the bank for unexpected emergencies and the next legislative session. Ankeny says he still has a good relationship with Bullock, but believes that veto was misguided.
I've told him time and time again, this $300 million, to put that above helping the people of Montana, that don't make sense to me.
Ankeny's bill received almost 95% of the votes of lawmakers when it passed. He is hopeful the bill has a chance to receive the two-thirds vote required in each House this time to override the veto, but he worries the governor's office will be pressuring Democrats to vote against it. It turns out, even though these vetoes received enough votes when they first passed to achieve the override, Secretary of State Linda McCullough says these overrides don't happen very often.
No, in fact, the last time it occurred was in the 56th legislature, which is the 1999 session, when the governor was Mark Roscoe.
The polls to override Bullock's vetoes close depending on when his office originally issued the orders. 5 are due on June 3rd. Another 19 are due June 10th. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Farmers are telling U.S. Senator Max Baucus that planned cuts to the proposed farm bill could make the crop insurance safety net too expensive. Baucus held a discussion with farmers and agriculture groups in Great Falls today. The six-term Democrat says the measure is a top priority for him before he retires next year. Baucus says he hopes to be on the important conference committee that could hash out partisan differences between House and Senate versions of the bill later this summer. Farm groups told Baucus they are most concerned about the way cost-saving cuts to farm programs can make crop insurance harder to get. They say the program is especially critical for new farmers trying to get loans and for stability in agriculture.
Lobbyists reported spending $6.1 million to influence and educate politicians during the 2013 legislative session. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports lobbyists for corporations, trade associations, and advocacy groups spent the equivalent of about $40,500 per lawmaker. State law requires groups that hire lobbyists or that use their own staffs to file spending reports with the Commissioner of Political Practices. The top spender was Compassion and Choices, which spent just over $160,000 advocating for physician aid in dying for people with terminal illnesses. The organization lobbied against a bill that sought to make physician-assisted suicide punishable by up to 10 years in prison. MEA-MFT, the union representing teachers and public employees, spent $120,000. Union President Eric Fever says its main issues were the state employee pay plan, pension funding, and school funding.
Members of the Montana Board of Investments have approved raises for some of its top personnel over the objections of the panel's former chairman. The salary increases include an 8.5% hike for Executive Director David Ewer and almost 10% increase for Chief Investment Officer Clifford Sheets. Six others will receive raises of 5.5% or 8.5%. The nine-member board manages Montana's $13 billion investment portfolio, including the pension funds for public employees. Board member Carl England of Missoula says the raises make up for several years of frozen salaries and will move the board's compensation closer to market averages. The former board chairman, Gary Buchanan of Billings, cast the lone dissenting vote today. He says the board's investment have underperformed even as costs have increased sharply.
A federal bankruptcy judge has approved a $3.25 million settlement that allows the city of Great Falls to leave a bankrupt electric cooperative. The Great Falls Tribune reports bankruptcy court judge Ralph B. Kirscher noted there were no formal objections to the settlement between the city and the trustee for Southern Montana Electric Generation and Transmission Cooperative. The power supplier filed for bankruptcy in October 2011. Doug James, an attorney for Great Falls, said he is thrilled the judge approved the settlement today. Yellowstone Valley Electric has already settled and left the co-op. The city has lost $7 million on its electric city power utility and estimates it will lose more than $12 million by the time the books are closed.
The director of the State Wildlife Agency says he's begun a review of its recent land acquisitions, holdings, and management. Jeff Hagener was director of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks from 2001 to 2008 and reappointed by Governor Steve Bullock, who requested the review. The Daily Inner Lake reports Hagener spoke with media in Kalispell yesterday before a regional staff meeting. The FWP land acquisition process became an issue last year when the agency bought 3,000 acres in Hill County for $4.7 million. After the sale went through, several area ranchers protested by closing their land to hunting and fishing. The 2013 legislature passed a bill that would have required public scoping for large land acquisitions and required the agency to respond to comments. Bullock vetoed it.
The attorney for convicted murderer Barry Beach is asking the state Supreme Court to reconsider its decision that put Beach back in prison after 1.5 years of freedom. His attorney said in the petition for rehearing filed yesterday that the Supreme Court originally ordered a 2011 hearing to determine the credibility of new evidence that Beach did not kill his 17-year-old classmate Kim Neese near Poplar in 1979. But his attorney says the majority of justices in the recent 4-3 decision, quote, discarded wholesale, unquote, District Judge E. Wayne Phillips's findings from that hearing and instead applied a new standard of review in the case. The ruling said Phillips gave too much weight to testimony offered by new witnesses who said Niece was killed in an out-of-control fight among girls.
The Lake County Sheriff's Office is investigating a suspicious death at Wild Horse Hot Springs, just north of the town of Hot Springs. Undersheriff Dan Yonkin tells the Missoulian that dispatchers received a 911 call around 9 p.m. Saturday from a man requesting an ambulance for another man who reportedly fell and hit his head. Yonkin says 28-year-old Lawrence Kenmill of Elmo was taken by ambulance to the hospital in Plains, where he was pronounced dead. His body was taken to the state crime lab for an autopsy.
Leaders of the Crow Indian tribe have reached a lease agreement with a Washington state company seeking to drill for oil on the tribe's Montana reservation. Spokane-based Blue Water Petroleum wants to tap a reserve of heavy oil, a thick tar-like crude that Blue Water Representative Tom Hines said will require an injection of steam to be extracted. The tribe will receive $10 per acre as an upfront payment and a 16.6% production royalty. The company has conducted exploration work on Crow land southwest of Pryor for the past 5 years. Its lease was due to expire this year. The new agreement extends Blue Water's lease on 16,300 acres until December 2015, Hines said. Blue Water hopes to begin producing oil by year's end. Surveys of the area have found as much as 2.6 million barrels of oil per 40 acres on portions of the lease area, according to documents posted on the company's website. It's uncertain if similar volumes exist elsewhere.
A pair of Canada geese that claimed squatters' rights to an osprey's nest just outside of Missoula Baseball Stadium didn't clear out in time for the osprey to assume their traditional nesting spot. University of Montana biologist Eric Green told the Missoulian yesterday that the geese left the nest in mid-May, not soon enough for the osprey. Green says Northwestern Energy allowed an osprey pair to build a home on the electrical pole about 500 yards south of the nesting site. The female osprey laid her eggs in late April, and the chicks should hatch by mid-June. Osprey had nested on the platform just outside the home of the Rookie League Missoula Osprey for the past 7 years. Next year, city park officials plan to protect the nesting site until the osprey return.
Scientists and others will gather in Yellowstone National Park for 3 days early next week to discuss what they know about the geothermal system in the Old Faithful area. The meeting will take place at the Old Faithful Snow Lodge and will be open to the public. In this evening's feature story, Edward O'Brien speaks with Yellowstone National Park geologist Dr. Frank Hessler about this conference and what scientists know, or perhaps more to the point, don't know about the Old Faithful area's geothermal system. He describes it as the world's greatest concentration of geysers, and it takes a unique set of geological features to make it all happen.
With the Yellowstone volcano. It's only a few miles, maybe about 5 to 8 miles depth there, that you will be at the temperatures of molten rock. So there's a lot of heat, and of course you need heat to have geysers and all the hot springs. The other thing you need is water, okay? And the Old Faithful area gets an immense amount of precipitation, so we have two components of the four components necessary for our geothermal soup here, if you want to think of it that way. The other two things we need is a plumbing system that allows the water to percolate in at certain rates and then to be expelled when it gets hot in the form of hot springs, geysers, and steam vents. And the volcanic rock that's in the area gives us that plumbing system, but that then also leads into the fourth component, which are earthquakes. Because the earthquakes have broken up the volcanic rock into a very effective, efficient plumbing system, and also the earthquakes help keep some of those plumbing pipes clean by breaking loose some of the interior deposits that form on them.
Dr. Hessler, next week, scientists, your colleagues, and managers will meet to chat about the Old Faithful area's geothermal features. How many mysteries could possibly be left there to uncover? It's got to be one of the most researched places in America.
Well, I don't think it's one of the most researched places in America. There's a lot of well-researched places in America. It's interesting that you think that so many studies have been done, because I'm on the opposite end of the spectrum, that there is so much we don't know about the system there. Frequently, visitors, especially young visitors, will express their amazement about how much is known about the Yellowstone volcano or Yellowstone geology or the geology of the hydrothermal systems. And after a few minutes, I think, of discussion with me, they understand that we're into the first paragraph of a book that's a very good mystery. And the other chapters of that book are yet to be written by future scientists.
So then what don't we know?
A lot of details. We have the basic concept of the four components of a good hydrothermal system, but key questions are, what's the sensitivity of these systems to the facilities that are needed for many visitors? So a key component of Yellowstone National Park is, of course, being open for visitors to enjoy and see their national, international treasures. And to allow that means we have to have facilities for visitors. We have to efficiently get visitors parking. We need to be able to feed visitors to allow some to stay overnight. And all of those facilities do have potentially some impact on the hydrothermal system. What this panel is meeting to discuss is, what exactly do we know about the system? Are there sensitivities that the park should be careful of? Are there not sensitivities that the park doesn't have to worry about? And then also to make observations about perhaps future key observations that might help park managers answer some of their questions about the amount of development that is needed in the Old Faithful area versus the protection of the thermal features. No one in the Park Service that I am aware of in any way wants to harm the thermal resource, but they want to make their decisions on how much development can go on based on good, sound science.
Then how could these potential and existing, I guess, services and facilities potentially impact these features?
Well, the question is that when you put in human developments, you start affecting all sorts of things. So even in cities, when they pave the roads and all that, what they have to do is put in storm drain systems, right? Because when you have a big, heavy rain, the water runs off into the gutters and the gutters overflow, so they have ways to get the water effectively channeled away from the city streets. Well, what used to happen before the roads were there is all that water would infiltrate and recharge shallow aquifers, things like that. And this is just any city in the United States right now, you know, I'm talking about. Well, we need parking lots at Old Faithful. Are they potentially affecting the thermal resource by changing recharge? We need to have water and sewer lines. Are they in some way affecting? What about the actual footprint of all the buildings? You know, we've changed that from what used to be in 1872, a totally natural area with very few humans, to probably the major city in the park as far as visitation. Some of the statistics I've been told by our planners is that approximately 90 to 95% of the visitors who come to Yellowstone, and that's around 3.5 million visitors a year, go see Old Faithful. And that in itself creates some massive traffic problems, feeding problems, taking care of visitor problems in the park. And this is not my area of expertise, but the park is looking at ways to more effectively and efficiently get visitors in and out of Old Faithful, serve visitors more effectively and efficiently. And a key component of that is, what's the sensitivity of the hydrothermal system? Because the park in no way wants to have more visitors, but then inadvertently end up impacting what the visitors are coming to see.
Wow, what a balancing act, huh?
Well, that's luckily I'm just the park geologist, and I get to look at the geology, but park managers have expressed their interest in getting good sound science to help them do this balancing act in a very thoughtful and careful manner.
I'm curious, Dr. Hessler, how many times a day do you get asked about a potential cataclysmic eruption in the Yellowstone area?
It's cyclic, just kind of like geyser eruptions, anything else. Near the end of 2012, I was probably getting about a dozen calls a week because of 12-12-2012.
Sure.
And I think we survived that. At least I think we're all still here. And to be honest with you, I enjoy those questions because it's a great opportunity to get people to sources of information where they can do additional reading, talk to other people, and it is a great educational opportunity that allows people to appreciate more some of the unique characteristics of Yellowstone.
And what last question, what do you think, if something like that were to happen, some terrible explosion, would we have warning, would we see it coming, or would it just pop?
Well, 2 points to consider. One is, as scientists studying Yellowstone volcano, and I'm in contact with most of them, they do not know if there will ever be another super eruption. You know, by super eruption, that just means a very big eruption. Okay, of over many hundred square kilometers of molten material ejected. So very, very large eruption. Now, do they know that a volcanic eruption is sometime in Yellowstone's future? Yes, they know that. So there's a very good monitoring system that you can get online and look at yourself through the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Many different agencies are collecting all sorts of data, and the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory website is a web portal, so you can see all that data. And the USGS, whose congressional responsibility is monitoring volcanoes in the U.S., very much has their finger on the pulse of the Yellowstone volcano, and I'm convinced would be able to give us significant warning for larger eruptions and warning even for smaller eruptions. So I live, I work here, I feel very comfortable here. I realize it's a very unique place, and consequently, whether it be bears or scalding water, I'm respectful of Yellowstone's uniqueness, but I'm not afraid of it.
All right. I've been speaking with Yellowstone National Park Chief Geologist Dr. Hank Hessler. It's really nice to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
Okay. You're very welcome. Thank you.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, tonight rain showers are likely with a chance of thunderstorms. Expect lows in the upper 30s to mid-40s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers. Highs will be in the 50s. For central Montana, tonight calls for rain showers and isolated thunderstorms with lows peaking around 40 to 50 degrees. Tomorrow, expect cloudy skies with a chance of rain. Highs will be around 50 to 60 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight calls for scattered rain showers with lows around 35 to 40 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain throughout the day. Highs will peak around 50 to 60 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Dina Mansour.
Government employee and proud of it. Why do I feel the need to say this? Well, for two reasons. First, the occasion of the biennial Montana legislative session provided the opportunity for much debate over the value of public services and public servants. Legislators were faced with making decisions affirming the value of the services we rely on and the state employees that carry them out. Among the issues under consideration was the first increase in base pay for state workers in 4 years, investments in K-12 education, and a proposal to expand Medicaid to 70,000 Montanans. One of the threads running through the debate was the anti-government tone of some in our state and in our legislature. While skepticism of government is an important feature of our democracy, today's climate has become increasingly dismissive of the work of public servants. What often becomes lost in the discourse is the valuable work that public servants do to promote transparency, responsiveness, and effectiveness in public service. I'm currently a state employee, but in the past have served the federal government, a nonprofit, and private business. I know the importance that each sector brings to our society. Having had the good fortune to travel to more than 40 countries around the world, I have a strong appreciation for the services that we tend to take for granted here in the United States. For example, when I traveled in Cambodia, I really appreciated the U.S. transportation system when it took me more than 4 hours to travel just 100 miles between two of Cambodia's largest cities on a so-called highway, unpaved and riven with potholes. Again in Cambodia, I appreciated our public education system when I saw kids barred access to school for not having the money to purchase a uniform or books. In Thailand, I appreciated our clean drinking water when I had to use bottled water just for brushing my teeth. In Indonesia, I appreciated our healthcare system when I contracted typhoid and there was no local hospital capable of providing treatment equal to what we have in the U.S. In Vietnam, I appreciated our freedoms when I wasn't able to log on to Facebook because it was blocked by government censors. And in Laos, I appreciated our regulation of business when I read of mining companies moving people off their homeland with little compensation. At the University of Montana, we have a number of units that focus on questions of public affairs and administration. I work at the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center, where the Mansfield Ethics and Public Affairs Program focuses on the relationship of values to institutions and public affairs. Its activities examine the role that ethical values can and play in public life, the moral quandaries faced by those who govern, and the issues of leadership and character in public service. The Department of Political Science at the university is home to the graduate program in public administration. The program prepares students for administrative careers in public and nonprofit agencies by developing skills and enhancing an ethic of professionalism in public service. So this brings me to my second reason for being proud of being a public servant. It's because of two men at the University of Montana who helped me understand the importance of our government and the services we all rely on. These two men retired this month after more than 65 years of combined service between them, James Lopatch and Jonathan Tompkins. In 1997, I arrived at the university seeking a master's degree in public administration and was more than a little nervous of what I might find. I had taken leave from my job in the federal government on the front lines of public service and was hesitant to immerse myself in theory and textbooks. These incredible teachers made me love the realities of running a government, not just any government, but our government. In Dr. Lopatch's administrative law class, I learned the doctrines of separation of powers and due process and how public oversight guides our democracy. In Dr. Tompkins' classes, I learned of principle-centered leadership and the responsibilities placed on public servants. I came away from my studies forever changed with a richer understanding of what I and every other public servant owes to our democracy. Jim Lopatch and John Tompkins taught thousands of students over the years the value of public service. Their work has been incredibly meaningful in educating students and society. Dr. Lopatch and Dr. Tompkins, thank you for the gifts you gave not only to me, but to the state of Montana. We are better as a society for having had these men at the University of Montana, and I am optimistic that we as a society will continue to refine our appreciation for the important work of public servants. This is Dina Mansour. Thank you for listening.
Dina Mansour is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. Just click podcast or check out our news blog at mtprnews.wordpress.com. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.